this week, the CEOs of Twitter, Facebook, and Google were hauled over the coals by a bunch of US senators.
Yeah, I'll tell you one shocking thing about those three is, what's the guy's Twitter CEO's name?
Jack Dorsey.
Beard?
He's got a ridiculous beard. He looks like Rasputin or something.
I think he looks like ZZ Top. Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. I know I say it every week, but it's nice to be in the studio. We've got bits of the country all getting locked down and stuff. Half of the north is locked down. I think London's worse than Hertfordshire where I live.
It's getting better in the northeast though, apparently.
Is it? Okay.
Levelling off.
So you just never know. I mean, France has just gone into full lockdown, haven't they, Pierre?
Yeah, tonight.
Damn. And you just feel...
Oh, sorry, 2 days ago.
It just feels like it's happening. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Allowing. I hope you had a good Halloween.
Do they go out like in London and get completely hammered in France and just sort of crowd city centres?
Yeah.
That's good to know. That it's
French
not just
is hammered all the time, though, isn't it? They have wine for breakfast.
Yeah.
Talking about wine, actually, we've got a bit of wine on the podcast because immediately after recording this, I've got to record the winners of the telecoms.com awards. Oh, my God, how exciting.
No, what do you mean? It'll be live.
Oh. Is it? am I ruining the magic?
It's okay.
I've got to record it, but it'll be like, I don't know, I'm confused now. Anyway, yes, well, it'll be live. Let's pretend this is done when it was live.
Dicky bowed up with your...
I know, Pierre tried to get me to bring my denim jacket. I just couldn't be bothered. Sorry, Pierre.
I know, first I tried you to bring your tux.
Tucking into your
jacket. Fine, let's go down to the tweed and no.
No, I just didn't fancy carrying it around because we always go for some beers after. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
You could just have worn it.
That's what I said.
Do you know what I mean? Look, this is my big concession, not wearing a metal shirt. That's how professional I am.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got some wine. I thought I'd introduce you to the Bechena House wines. I brought them along, ostensibly for us to sip while we do the awards thing, but we might as well get cracking, eh?
God, yeah.
So they're both Spanish. This one's called Saleta. I get these from the Wine Society. And they're good value because neither of them are Riojas, even though they're Spanish. And this one's got a little bit, the secret of this one's got a bit of Moscatel in it. Is it a bit more sort of stone
Rioja
fruit?
Riojas are more expensive then.
Well, it's just the best known brand. You know, you pay more for a Bordeaux than something that's in, you know, wherever.
Languedoc.
There we go. And then here's the red that I keep around the house called Cruz de Piedra, which is a Garnacha and is from, I can't even see, somewhere near Barcelona, I think. And this is really nice. It's got a bit of that Rioja oakiness, but not too much. And it's sort of smooth and balanced and goes down a treat.
A bit of
leather. I reckon
leather.
We should talk about wines more than
it would
telecoms.
Be good, wouldn't it? So let's. And Ian, you brought in your picnic wine glasses.
Yeah.
So
I haven't seen much use recently.
Well, there we are. We're about to resolve that. I thought we'd start with the white because A, it's still cold, and B, it's got less alcohol.
What about
than
the man
red.
Over there?
I know we haven't got an extra glass. Sensible.
Is he?
Oh, yeah. Dear.
That's not good.
Okay, so that's enough time wasting. Apart from cheers,
right,
Ian.
Cheers.
No, all this maze of microphone stands that you've got to deal with.
Good nose.
Mm.
She's a beaut.
I get peach, asparagus.
Oh, I'm getting flutters of nut. And
we don't need to hear about that.
Yeah. Leather?
Yes. Okay, so what are we going to talk about? Oh, yeah, just to remind you that if you're watching this on the site or on Facebook or on YouTube, you can listen to it on iTunes, SoundCloud, and loads of other, and Spotify, and loads of other podcasting platforms. And we're going to chat about this week. So, Ian, if you're somewhere short of your normal supreme excellence, it's because you've technically been on holiday this week.
Yeah,
but you've been dipping in. You just had a staycation, innit?
Yeah.
I'm going to test you and see whether you've been paying attention, see whether you've got a life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you haven't got a life, you'll know everything that's going on.
I do know quite a lot about the Nokia stuff.
Right, so that's what we're going to start off with.
Yeah.
We're going to start off with Nokia's quarterlies. I think then we're going to move into a Scott bugbear, which is to do with social media censorship and specifically a thing called Section 230, which is a US law. And then we're going to finish off talking about Ericsson, I think, because they had an announcement at the start of the week and you covered that as well, didn't
you? I did, yeah.
So there we go. So I'll crack straight on with Nokia. So the top line with Nokia's quarterlies is that their sales were organic down about, was it 7%?
Organic decline was 7%,
yeah.
I think. Reported was about 3%.
Right, okay. And so organic's adjusted for adjustments and all that sort of
thing.
Yeah,
constant currency, basically,
all
I
that.
Think, yeah.
And so that's not great. That's not great, but, you know, okay, fair enough. But then they also... So they got a new CEO. Is this the first quarterlies with new... Was Pekka Lundmark?
Yeah, he started on... Pekka Lundmark started on
I didn't write a PRL Pekka headline like we thought we might.
I tried to come up with something and it was just a bit silly and contrived.
It's forced.
It was too, you can't force these things, I don't think.
You can't force your Pekka.
No.
Anyway, now,
if he gets re-elected to the board at some point, then we can have a headline that says something like Nokia keeps its Pekka up.
There we go.
But until
that seems to be about the only headline.
That's the only one I can think of. But
okay, all right. But so that sort of dereliction of journalistic duty aside, so it's his first one.
Yeah.
And he also announced two other things. He downgraded the outlook.
Yeah.
And he announced a bit of a rejig.
He did.
Which is one of the reasons I got a laptop fired up, because Wade covered this for us, and I've kind of forgotten.
I can vaguely remember the rejig. Yeah.
Okay, well, why don't I pass it to you and you can tell us.
Yeah, so, there, I mean, first of all, I have to say, I thought it sounded quite impressive.
Okay.
He did work at Nokia years ago, and then I think he's been at an energy company. Is it called Fortum?
Yeah, that rings a bell.
And then he's back now at you know, hasn't been in telecom for a while, but has come back, has obviously been trying to get up to speed on what's going on. So he's not as, I mean, I remember when Ekom Ericsson CEO came on board there and very much described himself as a rookie, you know, without telecom experience.
Yes.
And this guy's maybe less of a rookie, but he's not been in the industry for a long time. And he's had to sort of get up to speed on what's going on, presumably, to some extent. I thought his delivery in the earnings call, it wasn't the earnings call, actually, it was a session with reporters very early in the morning, UK time, that I remember joining. And I thought he was very slick, seemed to have a good sort of grip on what was going on. The thing that really stood out, I mean, you know, CEOs come along and they want to make a sort of clean break with the past, don't they? And sort of show that they're trying to chart a new course sort of thing. So the thing that really stood out for me was this end to end, basically. You know, this strategy that Rajiv Suri had.
So that's the sort of rejig.
Yeah, and it's actually quite dramatic, because the whole justification for Nokia, but one of the justifications for Nokia buying Alcatel-Lucent back in 2016 was that they felt they were too mobile only.
Right, and so now you can buy the full Monty.
Yeah, they wanted to have all the sort of IP and optical and fixed line stuff that Alcatel-Lucent was really highly regarded for.
And let's not forget Huawei can provide the full Monty.
And that Huawei
can
provide.
It?
So, yeah. And meanwhile, you know, Ericsson's very much gone down this mobile only, let's be very focused on 5G route.
Yeah, do you remember when they had their little strategic partnership with Cisco?
Yeah.
It's just so hilarious.
Yeah, which
I don't think anyone bought it at the time, did they?
No, not at all. Was that was pre-Ekom, wasn't it? I think that was under Vestberg, yeah. And
that was a reach.
Yeah. and you know, the sort of the whole, so that one of the whole rationales for this, you know, Alcatel-Lucent takeover was to have the sort of full spectrum of technologies to be able to, you know, products to sell to your customers. And they made a really big thing of this. You know, I remember sort of meeting Rajiv Suri even in London and interviewing him, and he was still, this was a year and a half ago maybe, and he was still sort of banging this drum about customers want to buy end-to-end products. You know, it's a kind of a good position to be in, to be able to sort of market the full range of, you know, range of tools, I guess, to a service provider. And pretty much the first thing Lundmark says when he gets on the phone with journalists is that's not how customers buy. There's maybe a 20% overlap between different areas. And it makes sense to me, because for years we've been hearing talk about disaggregation, you know, multi-vendor, and, you know, companies wanting to have different vendors in different parts of the network, and maybe then
Nokia's gone and buy absolutely everything off us. They might as well be delivering their milk for them as well.
Yeah, and I think the other issue for them was that it made, you know, they had everything, they had this big networks division that had mobile together with IP, together with optical, together with fixed access, and it was quite... And I've always thought this when you're looking at their results, it's quite hard to figure out. I know they break out some of the top line stuff, but it's sometimes hard to figure out the key performance indicators for different bits of it, how they're doing. And I think there was a feeling that maybe some of these teams were too worried about selling all in one deals rather than just sort of, you know, let's focus on getting a really good mobile deal.
Yeah, it must be difficult.
You know,
I've never tried to sell telecoms kit on a B2B basis, but it must be difficult if...
Not somewhere I've been before either,
But, you know, we write about it and we've elected ourselves expert gobshites on the matter. that, you know, if the customer's going, to be honest, I just want a bit of help with my RAN at the moment, and you're sort of incentivized to try and sell them a bundle, it must be an active hindrance.
Exactly. And I think that was what he was thinking. And so what he's basically done, he's said, we're not going to do end-to-end stuff anymore. He's broken that apart. So there's now a mobile-only part of the company, which is the biggest bit. I mean, that's almost half of Nokia's revenues is mobile access. And that's going to be led by Tommy Wito, who's already head of mobile, but has done a pretty good job, I think, of coming on back in, I think it was late last year, actually, that he took over and has tried to sort of restore that division, I guess. It had made a few sort of, I think you can only call them strategic blunders. We talked about it a lot before. Yeah, all sorts of things they'd done. You know, they had all sorts of issues. They'd underinvested as well, I think. And he's basically been trying to get that back on track and seems to be doing a pretty good job of it. And I think Lundmark's recognised that and kept him as the man who should lead mobile. But it's now this standalone division within Nokia where you'll be able to see, you know, it's just one of the things he said, it'd be much more transparent to investors how it's performing, because you'd be able to see, you know, the numbers that are kind of broken out, and hopefully a lot more sort of key performance indicators for that part of Nokia. And then it's just going to be focused on doing the best job it possibly can. So he's one of the things that got widely reported, I think, by the mainstream press was, he actually came out with this statement, we will do whatever it takes to win in 5G, to lead in 5G, I think he exactly said.
What's that mean?
Well, I think one of the things he meant was, you know, and this is, it's almost like a copy of what Ericsson's done, is that, you know, Ekholm came on and emphasised the need for 5G leadership. Everybody obviously thinks it's important to be, as a network player these days, to have a strong position in 5G. And at a time when Huawei's losing traction in Europe and there's an opportunity there to be grabbed, it would be, you know, and that's by, as I said, that's by far the biggest amount of revenue that Nokia generates. It's absolutely critical for them not to fall behind in that particular technology.
Especially as they've basically got tons of business almost handed to them on a plate.
Yeah, and they don't want to be there with everybody sort of saying, well, we're mainly going to go with Ericsson and maybe even Samsung and Nokia. Well, we'll give them a little bit. So, you know, he's realised there's an opportunity there. They've underinvested. Things are getting back to where they should be. But I can see, and this is why one of the reasons I think, so the big news as well was that the share price went down a lot.
Yes, it did.
And I think one of the reasons was about 18%, I think, or 17 or 18.
It might have been about 17.
I'm not sure what it was at the end of the day, but but that's a big dip. And there's a couple of reasons. One is he lowered the outlook for this year.
Yeah.
But he also gave a fairly sort of low forecast, I think, for 2021 operating margin.
21's going to
7 to 10%, which is lower than Ericsson's looking at. And I think one of the reasons is they just want to start investing more than they have done. I mean, if you look at Nokia's R&D spending over the last few years, it's the only one of the big vendors where it's been going down. Now, they have said they're investing more in 5G. That's the area where they're, you know, pumping more money in, and they've almost sort of ring fenced that. But, and this is the other thing. So the breakout will make it obvious how much they're actually spending. You know, people can actually see that. And knowing that people will be able to see that, I think they're obviously going to have to commit a lot more to R&D in 5G than they have.
So it's almost
done.
Like he's burning that bridge.
I think he's basically saying we need to, you know, I can see R&D going up quite a lot at Nokia.
I'm afraid the margin's going to be screwed for a bit.
And this is almost exactly what Ekholm did when he came on. He spent a lot more on R&D. It was a lot of pain at first, actually. We were raising questions about whether he got things right. You know, does he have a clue what he's doing? I remember sitting in podcasts and talking about it. And, you know, he's done a pretty fabulous job. So he's almost kind of doing what Ekholm's done on the mobile side.
Yeah, I think so. Because the basic thing, I think we might have spoken about it recently, the basic corporate turnaround thing, which seems best practice. And let's not forget, Ekholm was a sort of like a top table sort of VC type before that. And you'd like to think that you don't get to that VC top table without knowing just the fundamentals of how to run large organisations.
Yeah.
But, you know, put it into words that I can understand is, before you do anything else, you've got to be in the black. Every quarter, you've got to turn some kind of profit.
Yeah.
As long as you're panicking about loss and you're building up debt, you know, and as national governments show, as you build up debt, you then end up spending more and more of your working capital on servicing that debt. And it's just your classic debt spiral situation. So that's the first thing you've got to do. And you've got to sort of downsize and streamline and all these other little corporate euphemisms that come along. because that's by far the most efficient way to get back in the black, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'd all like to sell more shit.
Yeah.
But if we're not, then we've got to get rid of people until we're back in the black.
Yeah, and I think that's...
And then build up from there.
The restructuring is obviously aimed at that as well. I mean, they said simplification, it'll make things, you know, whenever people say simplification, it's one of those sort of euphemisms they throw out there, I think, for more, probably more job cuts and
yeah.
more streamlining.
And I think there was a... That was implied.
I think it was implied, wasn't it? Yes, and so the other divisions. I mean, before we move on, maybe, but the mobile's been carved out into one unit. Then the rest of networks is basically those Alcatel-Lucent parts that they really wanted to get hold of. So IP and optical and fixed are sort of their own division as well. And then he's got this new unit which essentially combines enterprise, which has been a real high-flying part of Nokia for the last couple of years, ever since it was kicked off, with the software division, which didn't have a very good quarter, actually, software. It really came partly off the rails after doing quite well earlier in the year. I think it's been hit worse by COVID, oddly enough, okay. than other parts of the business. But those two are going to be combined, and it's basically been rebranded Cloud and... I can't remember the name of it. Something like Cloud and Software or something, right. that unit. And then Nokia Technologies, which is the licensing and patents business,
that's
is basically
distinct
exactly
anyway.
The same. So that doesn't change.
That's
but,
just patent trolling.
So it's almost kind of separating things out in a way that they've not done for a long under Suri because they have this whole end-to-end approach. And I think it's quite a big change. I think it's a big break with the Suri era.
Is it a positive move?
Yeah, because I don't think I think clearly the end-to-end stuff wasn't working, and I think he's come in and recognised that, and he's probably talked to a few customers. You know, he's this is what I'm impressed about, I suppose, is he's come in, I think, with a good understanding of market dynamics at the moment, and he even gave his little sort of take on how he sees things developing over the next few years in terms of where the growth's going to be, which I thought was chimed exactly with what I've always thought. You know, he was saying operator spending is not going to rise over the next few years. There's no growth opportunity in itself in, you know, looking, there's no point in hoping that operator capex is going to go up, basically.
Beyond the normal.
Beyond what they're spending at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, if you look back a few years, there were suggestions coming out, probably from analysts to some extent, that 5G would trigger this wave of
right.
ridiculous spending. And, you know, there were sceptics saying it's just going to be at the same level. It's always going to be sort of 15 to 20%. There might be a little bit of an uptick, but...
So there's the, you know, we understand that a new generation, to some extent, is just you just upgrade some kit,
yeah.
And there'll be a finite spend. Then it's just a matter of how quickly it's done,
yeah.
So does all that happen?
There's densification. There is some.
Well, exactly. That's what I was just
going
to lead up to. So there's, and on paper, if you were going to be an analyst who wanted to write a really bullish forecast, you could go, well, they've got to have four times as many sites as they do now,
yeah.
So that's four times as much.
Yeah,
brand
you could do, and I think maybe there was a bit of that going on, but you know, it's the market's more like this. It's little gentle waves rather than
yeah.
massive peaks and troughs. I think in equipment, network equipment, and really the opportunity I think probably comes from what's happening geopolitically at the moment,
well,
really
yes.
for the big companies. And you know, and it is a big market. It's where they make most of their money. It's almost 50% of the revenues network the mobile side. So you can see why he wants to be there. But he was saying that the growth opportunity is actually really enterprise. You know, that's where, you know, and I completely agree, you know, private networks, you know, enterprise customers building out their own technologies and taking advantage of cloud. So that's where Ericsson and Nokia are going to be able to grow their, that's where they're going to become bigger companies from a sales point of view.
Right.
It's not from selling
not
equipment
from
operators.
Yes. So, I mean, and that's been the narrative with 5G on the whole from a B2B point of view,
yeah.
is it opens up new channels rather
yeah.
than the operator channel.
Yeah. And then the other thing you noticed was network as a service, which I guess is this whole cloud services software. You know, he's very, I mean, you could argue that Nokia perhaps has been a bit more aggressive on the whole Open RAN thing, you know, virtualized networks and, you know, moving to those different models and ways of doing things. They've probably been a little bit more aggressive and on that than I think Ericsson has. They've sort of seen it as an opportunity, perhaps
well,
because they're smaller
we'll get onto
and,
that later
and they
as
see
well.
A chance
yeah.
to disrupt. So, you know, he was very sort of aware of that going on and the importance of sort of playing into that as well. So I think he's, you know, for a guy who's not been in the market for a few years and has come back in from an energy company and he gave his little take and said, that, and this is how we're responding to it initially. I was quite impressed. And
okay.
then I think their next, they've got a capital markets day in January, I think, when they're planning on providing a lot more. There was only so much said. I mean, the carve-up.
They didn't even have their PowerPoint up
They didn't
a
have
while.
PowerPoint. There's only a little bit said, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, there's the structural changes. There's the end-to-end. But there's going to be a lot more detail, I think, coming in January about what they're planning. And, you know, they didn't say anything. I mean, I think there was speculation over the last few months about divestments, you know, and selling bits of the, you know, I guess if you think that they are saying we don't think end-to-end is the right approach anymore, that does then open opportunities to start flogging bits of the business. You know, you could then say if you're putting all the mobile stuff here and you're putting all the IP and optical stuff here, all of a sudden it makes it easier to carve out one of those.
This takes me back
to
how Nokia flogged its way to becoming the company it is now. So when I was writing about Nokia a lot, and when it basically fell off the perch because it was primarily a mobile phone company, let's not forget.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I first started becoming an analyst, which would have been like almost 10 years ago, I think, Nokia was number one handset company, both in terms of feature phones. We still spoke about feature phones and smartphones back then, and they were kicking ass on both. We got those classic old feature phones that everyone remembers playing Snake on and stuff.
Yeah. And then you had those tiny little things. I mean, that's
those little fellas
that
as well, yeah. And, you know, and those things were durable, and everyone joked they'd survive a sort of nuclear war and all that sort of thing. Yeah. But then you had their Symbian smartphones, which before iOS and Android came along was the dominant smartphone platform. And so they fell off that perch, you know. They were top of the world 2007. By 2010, their smartphone side of things was fucked.
Yeah, that's pretty radical, isn't it?
It's incredible how things can move. And, you know, they were in denial for a bit. I remember writing some stuff when I was at Hexus. So this is pre-becoming an analyst. This would have been about 08, 09. I remember going to Nokia World in Excel. And there are all these sort of defiant Finns going, why has everyone got a problem with Symbian?
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, Symbian's fine until you try iOS and Android, and then it's shite.
Yeah.
You know, it's called disruption, son. And then when they finally sort of woke up and smelled the coffee, they did a reorg where they split Nokia into four distinct chunks. There was the handsets bit. There was the networks bit. There was Here, which was their acquisition
the mapping
of Navtech.
Stuff, is that? Yeah.
Of what?
Was it? Mapping.
Yeah, Navtech, I think, was the acquisition. Yeah. They spent an absolute ton on Navtech.
Yeah.
And then there was Technologies, I think.
Yeah.
And so they sold Here to this consortium of German car makers. They sold the handset bit to Microsoft, which just went Pete Tong for Microsoft. I remember writing about it here that they actually wrote off the entirety.
Yeah.
Of that acquisition, about 20 billion or whatever. It's like a nice one, Microsoft. Although, I wish I bought some Microsoft shares.
One of the
worst
ever acquisitions.
Yeah. And they've done plenty. Yeah. But their share price has gone through the roof, man. Anyway.
Yeah.
And so then they were left with the networks plus the technologies bit, which we both agree, the technologies bit is just standalone.
Yeah.
And there's just all this IP from Nokia back in the day that continues to have residual value as per the HMD smartphones and all that sort of thing. And then they thought, okay, well, seeing as we're primarily a networking company, let's go crazy and buy Alcatel-Lucent. I think it's hard to view that. How long ago was it? Like
2016.
Right, 4 years ago. I think it's hard to view that as an M&A success. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't think it's the disaster that the Microsoft purchase of the phones business was. You know, it's not like...
Well, it's not as much written off, but... In terms of the size of the acquisition compared to the size of Nokia, it's worse.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Nokia's share price over that, I think it's come down massively since before that acquisition. And, you know, as I say, one of the reasons for them buying that is that they thought they needed a broad array of stuff, basically, to compete at the top level against the likes of Huawei. And it hasn't really paid off, has it, in that respect? You know, they've struggled with integrating. I mean, one of the reasons, actually, that they've gone all wry in the 5G market is not just this whole FPGA stuff, you know, using pricey chips rather than the cheap ones that rivals were using. It's also because apparently they were struggling with the integration of the Alcatel-Lucent.
And it's always
Nokia business. Integration's
always
a bloody headache with stuff like this. And they've got a history of doing this. Alcatel-Lucent itself, that merger of Alcatel and Lucent was massively problematic for years, you know. And I don't think Nokia Siemens was necessarily a great combination either. So that company has been through so many M&A, you know, loads of merger activity and takeover activity.
Not that we're slagging off really acquisitive companies, are we?
But yeah, big deals often don't work out very well. You know, it's very rare that you see a big deal sort of.
Yeah, you know, well, I'll say that for our acquisitive company, that they're a bit more like sort of bits and bobs, like you guys. No offense to.
Yeah, I mean,
you
we're not like a mega takeover, are we?
But those existential M&As. So it's funny. There was a real sort of overlap because I wrote this week. I wasn't intending to talk about it, but I'll go off on this tangent quickly about. A company called AMD buying a company called Xilinx.
Right. I sort of clocked that while I was at Brighton getting rained on.
And and there's two reasons why it overlaps with this story. One is that Xilinx is the inventor of the FPGA.
Yep.
So there's the overlap there. And then the other one is that back in the day when I wasn't, when telecoms wasn't my core beat and sort of more tech and semiconductors were, I was covering AMD buying a company called ATI. And ATI, AMD made CPUs. And ATI made GPUs, graphics processing units. And there was a very similar narrative about synergies and end-to-end and all that crap. All this stuff that looks great on PowerPoint when people have decided. I mean, for some reason, execs just have a hard-on for just M&A. They just love it.
Yeah.
That's what being an exec, that's what they...
Well, it's like Royal Bank of Scotland, you know, buying ABN AMRO.
Yeah,
you know,
that's one of the reasons why they absolutely love. I think it's just buying stuff. I think it's not too dissimilar to them going into a showroom and buying a Ferrari. They just love buying stuff.
It's kind of a big stamp of what you've done with the company.
Yeah.
It's like building a big, expensive railway line from north to south that has absolutely no purpose whatsoever.
Yeah, but
as a politician, you can go, oh, I did
HS2. Look at me, that's my legacy. It's a lot of that legacy and ego.
White elephant type stuff, basically. Yeah.
And that was a nightmare for AMD because the presumed synergies of being able to provide both CPU and GPU weren't there. Because, again, this is what the customers were buying. Customers being laptop makers and to some extent, server companies. You know, people weren't saying what we, you know, HP or Dell or Acer or whoever weren't saying what we really need is to be able to buy the CPU and the graphics card from the same dudes.
Yeah.
There was no pain point there.
And obviously, Rajiv Suri, I mean, I'm sorry, but he hadn't really done his homework, it seems, because if this guy's just come along and said only a fifth of deals have any kind of overlap at all,
then what's this?
Then he completely misinterpreted what was going on, didn't he? And because this was his big thing about it.
Exactly.
End
so
to
I think
end.
They get blinded. So I think they like mobilise. They get to a certain stage where they smell blood in the water and like, I really fancy a bit of M&A.
But maybe there's now a bit of a, you know, it's interesting that the guy who's leading Ericsson at the moment has come along, and he'll probably be remembered as a guy who, I mean, we don't know because his tenure's not over and who knows what might happen over the next few years. But I think we can all agree he's done a really good job in the last 3-4 years that he's been there.
No complaints.
And he's not done anything fancy. He's sort of sold a few things. He said we need to invest more in 5G and we need to sort of focus on some areas that we didn't do before. He's made a couple of small purchases, Catherine, an antenna company, and, you know, the kind of targeted things.
Steady.
But he's not done any of that. I mean, I remember his predecessor, Hans Vestberg, he seems like a big sort of swinging dick kind of a guy, was out there sort of buying all sorts of shit.
And he had to sort of undo that.
Yeah.
And you look at some of the other M&A that Suri did, like buying into... a sort of medical wearables and that kind of stuff. I can't remember the name of the company. Withings, something like that?
That's it, yeah. Healthcare type stuff, Withings or whatever,
I haven't quite reached Biden levels yet. I was actually chatting to someone who I won't name, but they said they know him and they said he's just...
Not with it.
Yeah, he's just away with the fairies. Yeah. Anyway...
Well, he probably won't be president for long. It'll be Kamala Harris. So.
Quite. That's all going to kick off next week. That'll be interesting, our next pod, talking about America going mental.
It's on the 2nd.
Next Tuesday, man.
Bloody hell.
Or as you're watching this, it's tomorrow. Anyway.
Okay.
Yes, so they bought Withings, and then within about a year or two, they were flogging it again.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of misguided stuff. And then you think, look, you know, as you were just alluding to, look, there's nothing wrong with rolling the dice. But if you're consistently rolling the dice and then it was demonstrably a bad move, sooner or later you've got to start to question the judgment of your M&A strategy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But I mean, going back to Lundmark and everything, I've got I thought he gave a good account of himself, and I, you know,
he
I
gave
think
good
that
quarterlies.
He did, and I think the I mean, he cannot be blamed for, you know, what's happened with, for instance, a couple of things we didn't mention, and which I think also had a bearing on the share price movement, although you'd think it maybe was factored in first, but they did lose this big deal in North America with Verizon.
Yeah, shock horror.
Yeah.
I was thinking that. It's because I was trying to remember who he was alluding to, and I was thinking, of course, it's Verizon.
They never really said we've lost a deal, Verizon gave a huge contract to Samsung.
Exactly.
I think it was perceived that Nokia was losing out there,
that seems to be a confirmation.
Yeah, and then one of the things that Lundmark said in his sort of little précis to the earnings was loss of business with a big North American customer.
Yes.
You know, is going to have an impact on market share next year. So none of this looks very good. They've left China, which Ericsson hasn't, which is the growth market in 5G, actually. That's the one that is growing.
Where Ericsson got all its wedge.
And that's where Ericsson did so well in its quarterlies. That's what. And so Nokia's, you know, not competing for 5G RAN in that market. And then, you know, they've got this market share number they keep throwing up now outside China, what their market share is, which is 27%. They're going to end the year at 27%, but it looks like it's going to go down next year because of what's happened with Verizon. So
yes,
he needs to sort of restore this... this sense that they're not on the back foot all the time, you know, that they're not kind of on a perpetual
slide.
Well,
I think also, and I'm going to move it on after this, not to try and cut you short, just because we've done about half an hour on it.
Yeah.
He needs to draw a line in the sand. I think a new person coming in, again, from my position of zero expertise about being the CEO of a large company, but as a commentator, I think when you come in, you got a sort of, yes, make your mark to some degree. You know, we're getting into sort of football manager territory here.
Yeah.
Yeah, bring in, you know, the spine of your team. You know.
Tommy Wiseau's is like star striker, perhaps.
A sort of solid Northern European defender, maybe a bit of Mediterranean flair up front. but I think as much as making a mark, I think you've got to draw a line in the sand and go, okay, that's where we are. And I think one of the reasons their share price went down is he probably deliberately... You know, like every time you look at quarterlies, often you have to have your sort of detective hat on because there's such sort of oblique language and such smoke and mirrors, and they try and guide you towards the good stuff and hide the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they bother, because surely...
Well,
you know,
maybe maybe he wasn't there, like you say, because he's just coming in.
But on the whole, I don't know why they bother, because their core audience are equity analysts who are normally pretty sharp cookies. But I think maybe just he didn't do that and just got it all out there and went, share price is going to do what it's going to do.
If it's going to go down a fifth, there's only one way it's going to go next time round.
Well, quite. And I think that's very sensible. Let it go down perhaps too far.
Yeah.
Because next quarter you can go, look.
Yeah.
Things are picking up.
And there's a lot of positive things about Nokia at the moment. I mean, I think they are, you know, under Wiseau, who's the head of mobile, they have made a lot of changes that are starting to pay off. You know, they've won deals. We've talked about this before in Europe recently. They've won some encouraging deals. And, I think if they can get the sort of R&D investment stuff sorted out, and maybe there's some margin pain to suffer at first because of that, then I can see them being competitive again and challenging Ericsson for business. There's all this Huawei work that's going to go. Let's be honest, Huawei's finished in Europe. Let's say it again.
Yeah.
And... you know, and that's a huge amount of work for the Nordic players to get, and it isn't going to go to Open RAN in the next few years either.
No,
that whole chestnut.
Oh, that was the other angle on the AMD story though.
Open RAN,
which not many people covered. I may be barking up the wrong tree, but you know, most people covered who are tech journalists who are talking about it as a sort of data center thing, and I'm sure it is. And you know, and taking on maybe NVIDIA in sort of AI computing and that sort of thing. I don't know why that keeps
Someone's
happening.
Trembling down there.
The building keeps vibrating. Do you think we're having an earthquake? That's all we need. That's the last thing we need.
There have been earthquakes in the UK, a few of them recently.
Yeah, mainly Leighton Buzzard.
Just
the aliens.
I don't know what that's all about. But Xilinx got this FPGA on the same day as the AMD acquisition happened. Xilinx sent me a press release about how they've launched some new bit of silicon that's specifically for radio frequency and all that jazz. So I agree with you. Open RAN's not going to be, you know, a competitive threat to Nokia and Ericsson in the short term. But I think we're going to start seeing companies like this, you know, new improved AMD. And they're, by the way, you know, their share price has suddenly shot up. They've started doing better in the last year or two.
Yeah.
Intel keeps trying to get me to chat to them about all the great stuff they're doing. I just can't be bothered.
I get that as well.
Yeah, yeah. No offense. If you do well, if you start Intel, if you start kicking some ass and selling some units, but I'm just not interested in talking to an exec to tell me what they're gonna do.
Yeah.
You know, if they suddenly start being a disruptive force in telecoms, then we'll chat. Till then, I don't want to see your PowerPoint on the matter. Sounds harsh.
You tell them, Scott.
Well, I do. Well, I tell their beleaguered PR representatives who've got the thankless task of trying to get me to turn up to stuff. Anyway, so yes, so that's it. I think smart move. If he's deliberately getting all the bad news out early, that seems like a strategically sensible thing to do. Okay, moving on. Should we top them up?
Yeah, it's about time, I think.
I think so.
Just negotiate the...
Do you like this white?
It's nice, yeah. I'm not normally a huge fan of white wine, but...
It's all right, isn't it?
But
it's fruity without being sweet. Pierre's like,
try some because
Pierre's
otherwise
like, to these English talk about wine.
I love the reviews.
yes, it'll be more of a bourbon man, isn't it, Pierre? Okay,
more of a pale ale man, I think.
I don't discriminate. Yeah,
yeah. I'm sure you know your wine.
Do
you think? I mean, do you, like when you're at school, just everyone just learn about wine as well as like biology and maths and
like, horticulture is like
2:30 to 3 fan wine.
Yeah, and cheese. Yeah,
and cheese. Yes. Okay, that's today. That's this week's xenophobia dealt with.
Cliches.
Yes, exactly. He's so long suffering. Yeah. I was joking when you weren't here, Pierre, that one day we should have a camera sort of panning to you looking absolutely gutted at me being a dick about France. But then I'd probably get sacked. Anyway, so let's not do that. section 230. So, yeah, this is a bit of a Scott bugbear, not very telecomsy, but...
Is this where you want to call the section, the actual...
Yeah, let's call it section 230. Okay, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit obscure, but there we go.
Mm. Sounds like a...
Something to do with
random
speech.
Site somewhere.
Yeah, it all sounds like a nut home, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He's been section 230'd. So this week, the CEOs of Twitter, Facebook and Google were hauled over the coals by a bunch of US senators.
Yeah, I'll tell you one shocking thing about those three is, what's the guy's Twitter CEO's name?
Jack Dorsey. Beard?
He's got a ridiculous beard. He looks like Rasputin or something.
I think he looks ZZ Top.
I was going to say, he put a suit on, but Jesus Christ, he could have trimmed.
His hair was all crazy around the back.
He really looks like someone who's been sleeping in a gutter for a few days.
I actually think he's one of those people who's so rich that he's sort of gone full circle and spends half his life like in the desert in the lotus position.
Yeah, well, he only eats food once a day, doesn't he?
Getting into all this stuff. Well, I think they start getting worried about mortality sort of unhealthily early.
Yeah.
Well, they're the kind of people who'll go into cryogenics, aren't they?
Mangoes and shit.
When it becomes available, freezing their brains or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it was apples. It was Steve Jobs. No, it was for real.
It literally was.
Yeah, yeah.
Too good. So yes, no, definitely ZZ Top weirdo Dorsey was quite funny on that. But the reason they got on there, and actually, you know, these things are always just a pathetic spectacle. Because you think, okay, this is some important stuff, which I'll get into in a sec, the actual substance of the law. But then these senators, all they do is grandstand and posture. And like the one that went viral was a senator called Ted Cruz, who was once a Republican candidate. And he just gave Dorsey a really hard time and went, who the fuck do you think you are?
Who voted you in?
Yeah, who voted you in?
I created a company, what do you mean?
Exactly, and he also completely missed the point. He went, you know, yeah. Who are you to decide what people can see? And Jack Dorsey, I actually thought it was funny. Jack Dorsey looked bored. It's just like you're not saying a single letter that I didn't expect you to say. You know, he obviously will have prepared well.
Yeah.
And he's going, well, who do you think you are telling people? You know, and he was just, it was a very crude, top line sort of populist pitch. And, you know, and Dorsey's obvious answer is, I'm not telling people what they can see. I'm just telling what they can see on Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if Cruz hadn't just been trying to play to the gallery, he could have drilled down into that and then got into the, well, actually, Twitter is the public space to some extent.
Yeah.
It's the streets.
Yeah.
Town Square.
Exactly. It's the hood. Mm-hmm. But he didn't, and that was just all a waste of time. And it's just a reminder of why politicians, you know, we've got to have them, but...
But Dorsey actually said, I'm telling people what they can say on Twitter.
Well... No, I can't, I'm not quoting him verbatim at all. And to be honest, I found Ted Cruz's posturing so tedious that I didn't even finish that brief clip that I embedded in the story that I put.
Yeah.
That's thorough.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? He might have just suddenly got his kit off or started playing sharp-dressed man or something. But the serious point that Cruz should have done, if he wasn't a politician and just interested in getting little self-aggrandizing sound bites, was Section 230. So Section 230 is a bit of the US Communications Act that says if you're a platform, then you're not legally liable for the content that you host. And obviously without Section 230, things like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube couldn't exist, mm-hmm. because it's not in any way practicable for them to edit in real time. You know, you look at the bouncing back and forth that especially happens on Twitter, which is the most real time of those platforms.
Yeah.
It's just not possible, even with an army of thousands of moderators.
Yeah. And AI gets it wrong. And also
yeah, so they have to put in algorithms and AI, yeah. and that gets it wrong and just looks for certain keywords.
Well, there's a story recently about it taking something out of the Declaration of Independence, I think, that made some dodgy references, and in context, obviously, but it just got rid of the whole thing, and it was actually a reference to the Declaration of Independence. So yeah. AI is obviously not...
It's a reminder that AI is nowhere near... Nowhere near what some of the sort of utopian or dystopian people think it would be by this stage. And so they need that protection, and I completely concede that point. The problem is that they're abusing that protection because they're increasingly acting in an editorial capacity. Now, you could say they've got to act in editorial capacity because they can't just let any old shit go up there. You know, if something's illegal, they've got to take it down. And that's, you know, I'm not going to get ahead of myself. But what they're increasingly doing is censoring on apparently partisan grounds. Now, I'll admit that I've got perhaps more of an accommodation for the right-wing conservative side of things than a lot of people in the tech sector who tend to be a bit lefty for reasons that aren't actually that immediately obvious. But there you go.
I mean, it seems like they think they're already subject to it. Why are they editing so much and why are they taking off? It almost seems like they are subject to it anyway.
Well, there's two or three reasons. The main reason they edit is because of advertisers.
Yeah.
That's the great unsaid thing. But, you know, every now and then you get this... I forgot what they call it. Something Ageddon. Adageddon? No, it's not that. Anyway.
QAnon? No.
Not QAnon. Oh, that's a funny one by itself. I can't remember what it is, but it's an internet word they use when every now and then YouTube cracks down on dodgy opinions,
right?
Or even contentious opinions. But basically, you get advertisers like big, you know, blue chip companies going, "Your algorithm served up our ad next to this sort of ranting."
Well, this
maniac.
Happened a lot recently with Facebook, didn't it? Where they were boycotting Facebook because it refused to take a stand.
Adpocalypse. That's it. Sorry. Yeah. Carry on.
I was just bringing up Facebook because I remember there was that whole incident recently when a whole load of big brands like Verizon and Starbucks and Ben and Jerry's ice cream and a lot of virtue signaling corporations decided that they were going to boycott Facebook for not doing the things that they wanted it to do in terms of what it was publishing.
And that was all,
that was all
promoted by a politically, I wrote about this, a very politically aligned organization that was just pathetic they were going along with it.
Yeah, that went away really fast, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it does. All you got to do is stand up to them. It's just a great big bluff. Basically, it's basically people coming up to you going, "Pierre, you know, if you don't do what I want, you're racist." And you going, "Well, I'm not going to do what you want." And they go, "Oh, you're racist." And you go, "Yeah, bye." And then that's the end of the chat. Mm. Because they're just using really crude, incongruous, pointless attacks to try and panic you into doing what they want. And as soon as a corporation stands up to them, it all just goes away, as you said. Anyway, so there's that. So, yeah, their primary driver is worried about commercial stuff, which you'd expect, and advertisers. So, and I don't have a big problem with them censoring for advertisers. And maybe advertisers are guiding them to censor conservatives more than liberals. I don't know. But they also, all Silicon Valley, so California is well known for being a very lefty state. You know, there's never any question in the election that's about to come up that California's going to not be Democrat.
Yeah.
And then San Francisco is about the most lefty of that, and Silicon Valley's about the most lefty part of San Francisco. So these are pretty lefty people by corporate culture. And that sort of percolates through. I don't necessarily think it's a sort of moustache-twirling thing at the top where Jack Dorsey gets together with Mark Zuckerberg and I've forgotten the name of the Google dude. And they all say, how can we, you know, how can we pervert the course of democracy and control society? But it just percolates, just like with the BBC. It just percolates through the whole culture.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so there's lots of evidence that they are censoring in a politically biased way. And that's where these people like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton and some other senator whose name I forget has been quite proactive on all this, are going, well, you know, that's quite enough of that. And he's got the FCC. There's a rare bit.
So Tom Cotton and that lot are annoyed that they're sort of blocking what might be perceived as being more right-wing content.
Yes, they're annoyed at what they perceive as selective censorship. Yeah. And there's a couple of ways of going about it. You could just try real sort of antitrust stuff of just forcing them to split up because you don't like how they operate. But I actually don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I think they've got to their position of dominance through more or less fair trading, you know, through merit. Yes, I know, you know, they get to a stage where they can buy the competition like Facebook's done with WhatsApp and Instagram and that sort of thing. But, you know, in a purely capitalist commercial sense, they deserve to be where they are.
Yeah.
They've just got products that people want.
Yeah, I think regulators have... I mean, this is a completely separate thing, but I personally think regulators have been behind the curve on all that.
Quite possibly.
I don't think they've realised what was coming, and it's not an easy thing to regulate in the way that oil might be, because they understand it now. They never really knew that buying Instagram and buying WhatsApp was... Arguably, they never really knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But this is off the topic anyway.
Yeah, but I agree with you.
We should talk about this on a future pod, though.
No, and I think you're right, and I think this is always a problem. I mean, I've been, to some extent, a student of the financial crisis of 2008, and that was a classic example of financial regulators being way behind what all these crazy people like Fred the Shred were up to.
Moody's was completely...
Oh, the credit rating agencies blinded. Were just in...
Yeah.
The trouble with them is that they earn money from... They earn money from the banks.
They've got perverse incentives.
It's like the audit companies, the big audit companies. There's four of them, and they get paid to do audits, and it just doesn't work. The system just doesn't work in that regard.
You're completely right. You're completely right. And you've got people like sort of Matt Taibbi and who's that guy, Michael Lewis, have all done brilliant
he's excellent.
Of reporting and all this stuff. As you say, we could do a whole podcast just on that. Getting back to Section 230. So, you know, if we accept, for the sake of argument, that their content moderation policies are flawed, then it's got to a point where do they still deserve this protection that Section 230 gives them? So we don't get that protection.
Yeah.
Something goes up on Light Reading or telecoms.com and it's libelous, we're in trouble. Whereas you post something libelous on Facebook, you're in trouble, not Facebook. So do they still deserve that protection when they're acting in increasingly editorial capacity? And that was what this conversation was supposed to be about. Now, I've been saying for ages, Section 230 should be changed such that your protection is contingent on you only censoring stuff that is actually illegal.
Yeah.
So people are always like, oh, you can't just let people, you know, invoke violence and hate speech and all that sort of thing. And hate speech is another. There's another podcast I could do just on that.
Well, that's a very sort of hazy term.
Yeah,
isn't it?
But we have to start somewhere, and so let's start with the law.
Yeah.
So the law says you can't explicitly incite violence. I could put something on Facebook going, everyone going around Ian's house and beat the shit out of him.
Yeah.
So that's illegal. That should be censored by them.
Yeah.
But if I put something saying, I just think Ian's a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be there because I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm just being
just
obnoxious.
An opinion about me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being obnoxious.
What are you saying? All these examples.
It's always Ian, isn't it? Well, I just thought I'd give you a break.
It's something
here.
To subconsciousness. Yeah.
So that's what I was... And I wish some of those conversations had come up, but I just think it's a really interesting point of law. You know, we're all part of internet culture now, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, this election, you've got all these social media sites tripping over themselves to try and sort of ban political advertising and
aren't they subject
to
that anyway? Do they have to be subject to Section 2? I mean, to me, I don't. Maybe I'm not understanding it, but if you make them subject to Section 230, that might lead them to be even more sort of...
But that's the point. There aren't very clear conditions attached to their Section 230 protection. That's what even the FCC, Ajit Pai, wants to clarify. It just wants to say, okay, we've still got Section 230. It's a complete straw man. Some people are arguing that they want to get rid of Section 230. No one's arguing that. That would be madness.
Yeah.
But we're going to keep Section 230, but here are the clarified conditions under which you remain under its protection.
Yeah.
And if they just said, if you censor anything that isn't demonstrably illegal in and of itself, then you lose your protection. That would just simplify the whole thing so much. Yep. And it would actually, I actually think the internet companies want this, because there's a European, I didn't even know, they've got a lobbying body in Europe that's, all of them are members.
Yeah.
Facebook, Twitter, everyone. And they're basically, they're constantly lobbying for more regulation. And you think that's a bit counterintuitive.
So do you think that, you know, you were talking about why these decisions happen and why there's this sort of slightly pro sort of left bias, and, you know, partly it's to do with the culture that they're in Silicon Valley and all of that. But do you think that they're reacting the way that they are doing and taking some things off because they're, I don't know, nervous about legal repercussions, and that if there was more clarity that it would stop them from doing things like that?
I think they're saying, okay, because they're all coming after them on antitrust stuff as well.
Yeah.
They're basically going, okay, then you tell us how to censor.
Yeah.
And then everyone knows where they stand. And that would probably also help them with their advertisers, who are their big thing they're worried about. Because if it becomes a matter of law, the advertisers go, how come you haven't censored Alex Jones? They go, we're not allowed.
Yeah. Alex Jones being this apparent conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. And he is a bit. He was just on Rogan. He's quite a ranty guy.
Because the BBC's example of one of his conspiracy theories was that he raised questions about mask wearing and how effective it is, which didn't sound like much of a conspiracy theory to me.
I find it funny because he's done much worse than that, you know?
So. Right. Yeah. It's odd that they gave that as an example then. Apparently that's what they talked about on Rogan as well. It was that topic.
There's another rant I could go off on things like the sort of gated institutional narrative. But, you know, it's all right. You know, if the New York Times or the BBC or the Guardian or whoever said it, then it's good reporting. Yeah. Alex Jones says it's conspiracy theorist ranting. It's often the same stuff.
Yeah.
That's why this New York Post thing was such a pivotal point, because the New York Post is not Alex Jones. New York Post is New York Post.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I better discipline myself and stop it there, because we've been going quite... How long have we been going? Do you see the little
50 time? 50 minutes.
50 minutes. We've only got 10 minutes. Ooh. So we better stop it.
God, it's flown by.
It's flown by.
Like no podcast ever has before.
I know. It can't be anything to do with the fact that we're sipping fine Spanish white wine. Ericsson and Cloud RAN. Mm. You covered it at the start of the week. You certainly did a better job than I did, so I'm going to hand it over to you. Yeah. That's no great compliment, by the way.
No, I mean, I'm trying to remember it properly now. But
a week's a long time in telecoms.
It is, yeah. They came out with this announcement that was a bit similar to the one Nokia had, I think, earlier in the year, where they've sort of said they're going to launch a set of virtualized, cloudified kind of radio access network products. And what does that mean? I mean, it's all to do with the baseband part of the network, basically the signal processing part of it. So, you know, at the moment you have heavily customized stuff that, you know, is dedicated equipment that runs, you know, software from Ericsson, and, you know, they kind of flog the, you know, they sell everything. They sell the system, and, you know, service providers use that, and it works out very well. It works effectively, and Ericsson's made a lot of money from doing this for years. So what they're talking about moving towards is a kind of disaggregated approach where you'd, in theory, I think, in future, be able to say, buy Ericsson's software, but then take a sort of standardized x86, you know, bit of kit and run
AMD
it off that. Maybe from, you know, from someone else. However, they're not at that point yet at all. It was a very sort of cautious, I think, tentative step towards this. It was, I mean, for a start, none of this stuff's going to be available, I think, until the fourth quarter of next year, they were saying. So it's a long way off. It's sort of pre-certified, pre-checked equipment that they're, which basically means that it's if there's a hardware partner there, it's all pre-approved. It's all sort of under the
it's very Ericsson. A best halfway.
Yeah, so Ericsson's still the one-stop shop basically that you go to get this, even if there's another company that's involved in the mix that might not have been before, and even if there is some disaggregation that's happened there. You know, it was very sort of, I mean, I can see what they're doing, because there's a lot of talk at the moment about this trend, and particularly about Open RAN, you know, moving to networks where you can take components in your radio access network from various different suppliers, and you can have a sort of mix and match approach.
Yep.
And, you know, this is one of the things we keep hearing about that service providers want this because they want new options. They want more competition in that market. They want the freedom to swap things. They want alternatives to Huawei. And I guess Ericsson has been perceived out of the big kit vendors. It's, well, big kit vendors out of Nokia and Ericsson, they've sort of been perceived as being a little bit more resistant to this than the Nokia,
I can remember. Do you remember before, just when, do you remember Ericsson did their sort of, shit, we're going to have to do something else because Mobile World Congress is cancelled. And they did it in a hotel in just down the road from here.
Yeah.
And we both just sort of, there was a time when they were up talking about Open RAN. And I think we both, and Ray as well, asked sort of cheeky questions about that. And they didn't know, a bit like...
There was they've softened their tone a bit, I've noticed, this year. I mean, I remember that, and Frederick Yedling, who's head of network, stood up and went, well, it's still not good enough in terms of performance and costs. It doesn't,
and we were challenging them, because we were headline chasing on them, basically saying it's rubbish.
And then I think recently, you know, I talked to him a bit about it when they reported last week, or was it the week before? Anyway, whenever it was, I remember sort of asking him, and he was like, well, you know, there are certain instances where this stuff might work, and there are other instances where you need more high-performance stuff, and we need to be able to sort of tick all the boxes. He was saying something like that. So I think they realise that there's obviously a lot of customers coming along at the moment saying, we want disaggregated stuff, we want Open RAN, you know, compatible equipment. You know, you hear the CEOs on earnings calls even saying that it's an important trend. So they're having to respond.
And all the operators, I think... Sorry to butt in, but I think all the operators have just seen this. However keen they actually are on the practice of it, they've seen it as a great stick to beat their suppliers with on price.
Yeah, very much so, I think. Yeah, and
at the very least,
definitely. Yeah, and they're having to sort of adapt. I suppose they're having to sort of bow to some of those demands, but they're doing it in a much more cool... I mean, Nokia's almost gone the opposite way, and it said, we've got everything's O-RAN compliant. They've almost overpromised. Yeah. You know, they had this big announcement recently after having the sort of... They came out with something that was a little bit similar to Ericsson's, actually. It was like, it's Cloud RAN, it's V-RAN. And then I remember a week later, they followed up with this, all our stuff's like fully O-RAN compliant, and
we
love it. All the interfaces are compatible with O-RAN aligned specifications.
They've got like badges and baseball caps.
And I think one of the reactions to that was, you know, a bit of scepticism that it would, because they were still advertising, obviously, a full product set. You know, there were no hardware partners mentioned in that release they came out with. It wasn't as though they'd proven that they could do this. They're just sort of promising that, you know, it was almost like they're saying, come along and buy everything from Nokia, but oh, if you do want to sort something out in future, it's O-RAN compatible. So, and, you know, people aren't, I think there's still a bit of scepticism about that, and people aren't fully convinced. Ericsson's been a lot more cagey about all of this, been a lot more sort of worried, I think, potentially, but a lot more sort of hesitant about it. And that came through. I mean, they made a big deal of this announcement. You know, it was all under embargo. I mean, we had to sort of sign.
They were like pre-briefing you,
pre-briefing. Please don't sort of say anything about it until Tuesday. And you know, I mean, it is. I think it is some important in a way, because I think if you go back a few years, no one would have perhaps anticipated something like this happening so quickly. And the market's really changing very fast now. It's really evolving at a fast pace.
Yeah,
but
especially
they're obviously. I mean, I asked the guy I spoke to on the phone, I think whose name...
I spoke to the same guy.
Per Narvinger, I think is how you pronounce it. He's pretty senior. He's head of products, I think.
Yeah, well, the same lad.
And really good guy. He can answer questions well. But I remember saying to him, well, you know, if you're not selling the hardware part in the future, which is what you're sort of implying in the press release, then just sounds like a smaller business for you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And they're sort of, well, you know, the market's probably going to be bigger because O-RAN will lead to new opportunities. So they're trying to sort of, but you can see why they'd be concerned about it, obviously, why this is
so I think you and I both agree that obviously Ericsson hates the thought of anything to do with O-RAN because it's a fundamental existential threat to its business model. But, you know, there was a... I think I remember when, I think it was an Apple thing. Maybe it was before the iPhone, when the iPod was their most exciting bit of kit.
Yeah.
And then they came out with a new iPod, which was much better than the old iPod. Maybe it was called a Nano or something.
Yeah.
And everyone's going, but what about the old iPod? Aren't you cannibalizing your shit? And Steve Jobs would be like, well, that's what you do.
Yeah.
If you're a good company, you've got to cannibalize yourself.
Yeah.
Because if you don't cannibalize yourself, someone else will. You know, which is actually such an obvious thing to say that it's almost ridiculous it has to be said. The only way your stuff isn't going to be obsolete is if there's no progress. And in tech, of all places, there's obviously been constant progress. So you've got a choice of you making your own stuff obsolete or someone else doing it.
Yeah.
The dilemma that Ericsson's got is, it's more comparable to something like Kodak.
Yeah.
So did you know that Kodak had a lot of the original patents for digital photography, but they didn't use them because they had so much invested in film? And in the end, other people came along. And to be honest, it would just been a stay of execution because obviously people just use their phones now.
I think it's a good analogy because I think Ericsson probably has, and I've talked to analysts about this, and you know, Ericsson obviously has the capability to do this. It's not like there's anything that's within ORAN that they can't do. I mean, all ORAN is
but
actually...
But they've just got so much invested in not ORAN.
ORAN seems to mean lots of different things to lots of different people. It's not really virtualization ORAN. Strictly speaking, all ORAN is opening up those interfaces.
Yeah, commoditization of the whole...
It's you can't at the moment take a radio and use that with baseband equipment from someone else because that interface that runs between them is semi-proprietary.
Yeah.
It's got missing parameters if you talk to experts. It's sort of not filled in, if you like. And what ORAN specifications are trying to do is kind of fix that problem and allow you to have interoperability. And then you can, so it's not really virtualization in itself, but there's nothing about that ORAN thing that Ericsson can't do. It doesn't even need
just
ORAN specs to do it. The big vendors could have interoperable equipment. They could deal with that issue themselves, but it's not really in their commercial interests, as you say. So I mean, in a way I think they're being quite canny because, you know, they're showing that they have the capability to do it. They're putting forward a product set that's not promising too much. They're saying, you know, we've now got a cloud RAN thing that deals with these target markets to do with low band equipment. And we still think the higher performance stuff is better for your urban areas and all that lot. And actually, if you look at the sensible forecast, we talked about this, I think, a week ago about
the DeLoro
and other sort of wilder analyst outlooks. But
yeah.
I'm very on the sort of side of DeLoro with this when I sort of, and actually Omdia has come out with some market projections as well that are quite similar to DeLoro's. I think a little bit more cautious, but they've not updated them recently. So we'll get an update, I think, next month from Omdia. You know, it's probably going to be in the next 5 years, you're looking at ORAN being a sort of 10% share of the market, perhaps, I think is a sensible way of looking at it, which is a big thing. I mean, if you think at the moment, this market generates about $200 million annually in a radio access network market that's worth $30 to $35 billion.
Right, so
that's
just
tiny.
A drop in the ocean.
So for it to go from there to 10% in 5 years is
and
a big ramp.
And if you extrapolate that curve.
But it's still not going to be the main thing by then, clearly. We're still looking at Ericsson, Nokia, minus Huawei in Europe, being able to sell a lot of dedicated equipment and do things the traditional way.
But they've also got to get ahead of the game.
But they have to get ahead of the game.
They've got to not be Kodak.
Yeah. Because who knows? Who knows? It could be what you were talking about earlier with the whole Symbian thing. Who knows if something like that could happen in networks, yeah? We just don't know. We can't. We can try and say what's going to happen, but we don't know for sure. So you have to cover your bases.
So they've got to learn from Kodak. Nokia's got to learn from its own experiences in handsets. And they've also got to, I think, demonstrate to their current customers that they're not being complete dicks about the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, if their customers are going, you know, you've got Vodafone and you've got Verizon and whoever, just going, well, yes, this ORAN. You know, and they all know they're playing a game and we all know the operators are using ORAN as a bit of a threat, as a bit of a negotiating tool. But they can't just go, nah, it's all bollocks.
No.
So I think what this was symbolic of them paying some respect to their customers, going, okay, we hear you.
Yeah.
We hear that this is a thing for you and this is where we're going in that direction. You know, one of the things, is it Narvinger?
Yeah.
Is that his name? One of the things he was going is like, you know, we still reckon that proprietary is better on lots of fronts in terms of cost effectiveness, in terms of obviously everything working.
Well, and you know what? Why I think he's right. You know, the big issue for me with ORAN, I think, is, you know, the reason that a lot of operators seem to be interested in it all of a sudden is because there's this big concern. It's not really about whether ORAN technology gives them, you know, advantages over proprietary technology. The reason there's a big push for it in, you know, markets in Europe and America at the moment is because they want alternatives to Huawei.
Well, that's what,
and they
definitely
want alternatives to Ericsson and Nokia. They seem to want, and I actually think there's a lot of protectionism wrapped up in this as well. There's
pushing
national champions.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just America. Look at what Japan's
doing.
That's
where a lot of the push is.
It's all about NEC. It's all about, you know, I was on a parliamentary briefing this week listening in.
You really have got no life.
I know that was Wednesday as well. I really was supposed to be off.
Supposed to be the middle of your holiday.
But it seems so fascinating. How could I possibly have a day's holiday when you've got Ian Livingstone, that former sort of BT CEO?
Oh, is that the group that like Ross Singleton's?
Yeah, so he was being quizzed about what his group's going to do, and then they got Tara Kim in from Rakuten on. But there's a lot of you can see the politicians are thinking, hang on a minute, is Open RAN an opportunity for us to get British innovation in there and British companies doing network stuff, which we haven't had that for years, not since the days of Marconi. You know, there's a lot of sort of politicisation of Open RAN.
Yes.
And the trouble is, one of the reasons Ericsson and Nokia and Huawei have been so successful is because they're massive companies with huge global economies of scale. If this starts to become a market where national players cater to that national service providers, all that disappears. You know, where are the benefits then on the cost side? You know, you might not have to worry about Chinese snooping, but what else are you getting out of it?
Yes, cool. Yes, and that sort of feeds into the sort of balkanization narrative that we.
I can see
about,
he's getting agitated. Yeah,
we're about an hour or so, and that was a natural pause. So I will wrap it up there anyway. Cool. Okay.
And excellent.
We've done 2/3 of a bottle of white, so well played us.
Let's finish it off then.
Well, I'll switch to the red for the awards thing.
Get some ice.
That is live. Mm. Anyway, okay, so I'll wrap it up there. Thanks a lot for watching and listening, and make sure you join us for the next one.